Okay, we're about to embark on a reading and discussion of the prophecy of Zechariah. It's a little longer than all these other minor prophets that we have discussed here recently. Zechariah can be dated rather accurately to begin about 520 BC, give or take a year or two before the, or around the time of the building of the second temple. Zerubbabel had already returned to Jerusalem with 42,000 people in the time of Cyrus the Great. They began to work on the foundations of the temple, and construction was halted by Cyrus's successor and son Cambyses. Now we have King Darius, known as Darius the Great in history, who came to rule Persia around 522 or 521 BC, and now a year later, he is allowing the building of the temple in Jerusalem to commence. Zechariah is a contemporary of Haggai. They prophesied at the same time of the same things. Haggai's prophecy is of course, much shorter. Zechariah and Haggai are mentioned together, and in the Septuagint version of what we have in the King James as Psalm 147. That psalm is 146 in the Septuagint. That psalm is credited to Zechariah and Haggai together. That was the psalm that extolled Yahweh for only having given the law to Israel and not dealing in that manner with any other people in the final verses or the closing verses of the psalm. That the fact that Zechariah's prophecy or the time of his ministry was not very long is evident in the book of Nehemiah, and it can be established that Nehemiah began his governorship in Jerusalem in 502 BC. And by 502 BC, we don't know how long Zechariah lasted, how long his ministry was. It could have been 5 years, 10 years, whatever. Nehemiah, by 502 BC, had found the priesthood in Jerusalem to be absolutely corrupt. They were already mingling with the other races, and he had to institute reforms. So this time of Zechariah and Haggai was a time when the people of Jerusalem were relatively disciplined in keeping the law, which is evident from their prophecy, but it didn't last very long. So here we are, 520 BC, perhaps, and that's the most I could offer at this time. That's all I have to say right now.
The Book of Zechariah. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet, saying, Yahweh has been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say you unto them, Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Turn ye unto me, saith Yahweh of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith Yahweh of hosts. Be ye not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, Turn ye now from your evil ways and from your evil doings. But they did not hear, nor hearken unto me, saith Yahweh. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? But my words and my statutes, which I commanded my servants, the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, Like as the Yahweh of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so has he dealt with us. Upon the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month Sabbat, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet, saying, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the and behind him red horses, speckled and white. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? And the angel that talked with me said unto me, I will show thee what these be. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom Yahweh has sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And he answered, the angel of Yahweh that stood among the myrtle trees, and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sits still and is at rest. Then the angel of Yahweh answered and said, O Yahweh of hosts, how long will you not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which you have had indignation these 70 years? And Yahweh answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. So the angel that communed with me said unto me, cry thou, saying, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy, and I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease. For I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercy. My head built in it, saith Yahweh of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, thus saith Yahweh of hosts, my cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and Yahweh shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. And then I lifted up my eyes, and saw, and behold, 4 horns. And I said unto the angel that talked with me, what be these? And he answered me, these are the horns of Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And Yahweh showed me 4 carpenters. What come these to do? And he spoke, saying, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head. But these are come to fray them, to cast out the horns of nations which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah, to scatter it. End of Zechariah chapter 1.
I'm sorry, I'm with you. I'm just not reading fast enough. This is when I presented my commentary on the prophecy of Zechariah, I don't know how many years ago, probably 7 or 8, or let me look, 2016, 7 years ago. I chose Zechariah to discuss the concept that of dual fulfillments in prophecy, which I called visions near and far here in Zechariah chapter 1, and the fact that not all, but many of these visions in Zechariah and in the other prophets as well, it's probably, if I can have the opportunity to present an Isaiah commentary, it's probably something I'm going to talk about at length in Isaiah. It's evident that these prophecies, many of them have dual fulfillments, one for the immediate time and one far, very far in the future, or as we always see, or as we often see in the prophets, in that day, in the day of the wrath of Yahweh, in the day of his vengeance. And of course, that day of vengeance is explained in the Revelation, and it's not fulfilled yet. So we still await that day. And a lot of these prophecies will certainly be pertinent at that time, and a lot of them are pertinent, and we can see them being fulfilled already before our own eyes as the revelation unfolds. Zechariah is also a prophet of the revelation, which we will see in many respects in the later chapters. The scoffers ask your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? And the truth is that yes, they do live forever, even if they're not here. And we still have their words today, and their words resound in our minds and hearts to this day, and that proves that they live forever.
And also, Bill, over time, different prophets gave the same testimony, proving that Yahweh is true. And they even acknowledge that here, because at verse 6, they say, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. So he told them before how he would deal with them, and he fulfilled that. So for me, this is another proof that Yahweh is the true God, and his prophecies come true, and he has true prophets.
Yes, I certainly would agree with that. Absolutely. Here in verse 7, we see that Zechariah is the son of Berechiah. And he's the son of Iddo the prophet, which we see means that Zechariah actually came from a whole family of prophets with a tradition. Iddo the prophet, but there's another, that there's an Iddo the prophet mentioned in 2 Chronicles chapter 12, chapter 13. Chapter 9, and that seems to be the Iddo referenced here. There's another Iddo the prophet later, who is at Caspiana on the Caspian Sea, Cassithia, in Ezra chapter 8. So other priests had that name, whether they're from the same family or not, it can't be told with any certainty. But it seems that Zechariah is not only from a long line of prophets, but that this Iddo the prophet in 2 Chronicles chapter 12, chapter 13, may be one of his grandfathers of whom he is son. It's not necessarily his grandfather as we know grandfather, but one of his more remote ancestors that's being mentioned here. And the Iddo the prophet was noted in those chapters of 2 Chronicles. That would be some time before this. That would be at least 120 or more years before this. I would have to see which. That's in conjunction with Jeroboam, the king of Judah, so it might be even a little sooner than that. But it's over a century before this time. So that could be Zechariah's ancestor, or it could be some other Iddo. But it seems to be where Iddo the prophet is specified, that it might be referring to that Iddo, who would probably be Zechariah's great-great-great-grandfather or something like that. The man riding upon a horse in the myrtle trees, where the King James Version has myrtle trees, the Septuagint has shady mountains. Those two concepts, I don't think they can be reconciled. It's just different language. The colors of the horses are red, speckled, and white, as they are translated in the King James Version. And in the Septuagint version of this passage, they are red, gray, piebald, and white. Now, piebald, if you ever had a dachshund, like we have a dachshund, piebald is usually a whitish or beigeish color, but it's also like multiple colors in the dachshund, and they call it piebald. And that corresponds to this Greek term, which is poikilos. And poikilos in Greek means spotted or mottled or dappled, being of an animal of variegated colors, right? So that those, even though they don't correspond exactly, it seems to me to be roughly corresponding to the four horses of the apocalypse, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And those four horsemen, they had represented different stages of the wrath of God in the fall of the Roman Empire. as I interpret the revelation. So Zechariah is seeing some sort of a vision of the wrath of God here.
In his own time, though.
They're sent, Yahweh sent them to walk to and fro through the earth, through the land. I'm sorry, Joe?
So this is in his own time. This isn't necessarily the future. This is in his own time. There would be these four horses walking throughout the Adamic Ecumene and bringing these fortunes upon that world. That's what it means?
Well, yes, it very likely means that in the near vision. And it was 200 years before Persia fell from this time. And there was much war in the Oikoumene up to the fall of Persia, where the Persians had, from this time, the time of Darius in 520 BC, if we read Daniel chapter 11, and Daniel's prophesying in the time of Cyrus, and he says, at this time, from here there will be three kings, and the fourth who will stand up and make war against the whole realm of the Greeks. Those kings are definitely identifiable and correspond to actual historic Persian kings. And Darius is not the... Darius is not the last of them. Xerxes is the fourth, and Darius is the second or third. I would have to look. I think he's the third. Darius is the third. He'll rule from 521 BC to 486 BC. Xerxes is the fourth king of Daniel chapter 11, and he made war against the whole realm of the Greeks. So yeah, that's what I think this judgment of God represents in the near vision, is the wars between the Persians and the Greeks, and the judgment which Yahweh God brought through that upon the Persian Empire when it was destroyed, and in the meantime upon the Greeks themselves, because the Greeks had suffered much destruction at the hands of the Persians, not only in the actual invasion of Greece by the Persians, which is detailed in Daniel chapter 11, but also in the fact that the Persians had instigated the Peloponnesian Wars, which really decimated both the Spartans and the Athenians, ultimately paving the way for the Macedonians and then the Romans. There was much destruction in after the time of this vision upon the Adamic Oikoumene.
Do the horses go in different directions, Bill? Like, does the white horse, is that for Israel, and like the other horses are for different nations? I can't remember that. Is that right? Like the white horse here would be for Israel because they get mercy.
I believe that's the way that I interpreted it. But I'm not sure if it's in relation to this chapter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's later.
Later in Zechariah, where it explicitly says that they go in different directions.
Yeah, and there's one direction where they're not allowed to go.
Yeah, yeah.
These horses are mentioned in, there's horses mentioned in Zechariah's chapters 9, 10, and 12, and 14. So I definitely believe that's in one of the later chapters. And I believe that those horses represent something different. Yahweh is jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with great jealousy. How long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah? So Yahweh admits that he's jealous for Zion with great jealousy and sore displeased with the nations that are at ease, which is basically Persia. Therefore, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies, and my house shall be built in it. That's just the hope that the temple is going to be rebuilt. So Zechariah is probably announcing this prophecy in order to inform the people of Judea that it's time to build the temple. That it hasn't actually started being rebuilt yet, but it's about to start. In another way, the carpenters represent horns, which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head, but these had come to fray them, to cast out the horns of the nations which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah to scatter it. That seems to be a far vision prophecy wherein Christ is the ultimate assembler of the temple. But in the near vision, the temple in Jerusalem is going to be built. So those four horns that are ultimately going to reassemble Judah, that could be a reference to the Gospels. It could be a reference to a few things.
Yeah, like, so through scattering, the temple's actually built.
Yes.
And so that would be the Gospel. That's why, yeah, no, that, I was going to ask that, and now that makes sense that you linked it to the Gospel.
I don't know what I said about it here in my commentary. Horns in prophetic scripture most often represent kings or kingdoms. The picture of world empires described by Daniel begins with Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel's own time. So Daniel only prophesied four beast kingdoms, two of which had not yet come in Zechariah's time, and here is Zechariah speaking in the past tense. However, if we look at the wider panorama of history, as Revelation 17, 10, and 11 also does, perhaps we can imagine that the four horns of the four beast empires that existed until Zechariah's time. From the time of the Exodus, each of those four empires did have a hand in scattering Israel and Judah and the people of Jerusalem, which is true. That's also valid. So I didn't link it to the Gospel at that time with the rebuilding. Let me get to the part with the carpenters. I'm not at the carpenters yet. There's four horns and then there's four carpenters, I gather. The four horns are in verse 18 here, and the four carpenters are in verse 20. Carpenters are not kings or kingdoms, but rather they are builders. The work which they shall build ultimately enables the people of Judah to overcome the horns which scattered them. Israel is not mentioned, which should probably be factored into the interpretation. Therefore, we may imagine that the carpenters are those who did the work of God in establishing a seven-week kingdom, ensuring that Judea would remain for the appointed time and purpose, which was to produce the Christ. That would be a short-term interpretation. However, we may conjecture that the transcendental interpretation, the long term, refers to the four Gospels of Christ. Which truly casts out the horns of all the heathen nations. So yeah, I did write that 7 years ago and I sort of forgot, but there it is. So I didn't forget. I remembered maybe subliminally or something. I don't know, man. I don't know. Because when I actually write my commentaries, I sit and focus on the prophecies and do my best to construct possible fulfillments of them, or fulfillments of them which have happened in history. And that takes some time. It's a lot more challenging to do it here on the fly and to have it discuss it here on the fly and have it make sense. It is. So I was kind of tickled by that, but I think it's funny. I kind of forgot it, but I didn't forget it, right?
Yeah.
So that's fine.
Yeah, you can't remember everything you wrote, Bill.
No, I can't possibly remember everything. And when I write my commentaries, I'll read the chapter on Saturday or Sunday and ponder on it all week, what I'm going to write. And I sit down Thursday morning and start writing. I mean, I just did the same process with the what I'm going to call the dedication of Isaac, not the sacrifice of Isaac. And on Friday, I've been thinking about it all week. So however it comes out, but I don't start actually writing it until tomorrow morning. That's my process. That's the way I've always done it. For better or worse, I try to do best I can with it. If you belabor it too long, then you're probably overthinking it. I mean, some arguments have been stored away for years, and it's taken years to develop them. Some perspectives and some of the arguments on some of my positions. It takes a long time just to develop the language sometimes to explain things.
Yeah, it does. You're always thinking of different ways you can say the same thing.
Right, but say it more efficiently and more effectively. We could get in Zechariah chapter 2, unless anybody has noble might, or anyone have any discussion, more discussion on Zechariah chapter 1.
I have a question about verse 10. In verse 14, when it says, "Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy." I was looking at Bible Hub, and the Hebrew word is kana, but it says to be jealous or zealous. Aren't synonyms though, aren't they?
That they're not synonyms, but what they reflect it is an emotional reaction to guard something, if that makes sense. If I could translate the Old Testament, I would translate it as zealous, at least in many cases. I mean, if you're zealous for someone or jealous for them, it's basically, in my opinion, it's the same emotion, even though they're not really synonyms in English. It's nevertheless the same emotion that's rooted in a desire to pursue or protect something.
Okay, because I always like equate the word jealousy with like what's that word? I'm trying to think of it. Envy. So I mean, he's not envious of Israel, obviously, right?
No, if you
or coveting.
If you love something and it starts to get pulled away from you, you're jealous of what's pulling it away from you, and you're going to pursue it and attempt to defend it.
Okay. All right. That cleared it up. Thank you.
So what's it mean?
If you don't have a relationship, okay, say I'm a young man, I'm courting a woman, or I want to court a woman, and I have zeal to pursue her, to court her, to get her to try to court me, right? and marry me because I want her. So that's zealousy, right? That's being zealous. So once I establish a relationship with that woman, and Joe comes along and he's trying to hit on her and court her because he wants her too. Well, now my zeal is going to be turned to jealousy, but it stems from the same emotion and the same will to have desire to have that woman, right?
Right.
What would zeal for God mean then, Bill? Fiery, passionate, devoted.
Devoted to God, a passion for seeking God. There's nothing wrong with that if you're doing it along the lines that he gave you to do it.
Christ even urges us to be zealous in the Revelation.
Yeah.
While condemning those who are lukewarm.
Well, I just wanted to say that I find verse 5 really interesting. Like, each generation of prophets dies, and then a new generation of prophets comes up and says the same things, the same testimony. And it's like generation after generation of prophets is testifying that Yahweh is true. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah,
generation after generation of prophets also gave these near vision prophecies that came true.
And some of them are
so near. Like, some of Daniel's prophecies aren't so near, right?
The
near-term fulfillment was actually a couple of centuries off.
He was probably the longest-seeing prophet, was he, Bill?
It was likely when he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dreams, I guess. That's what, like, got him accepted.
Yes. Daniel's prophecies took 1,000 years to unfold in the near vision, right? In the immediate sense. And Daniel was probably the longest operating prophet. Isaiah was long. Isaiah was 45 years probably, but Daniel was longer. He went into captivity with the 10,000 princes or whatever it was, the principal men in 604 BC, along with Ezekiel. And they both started prophesying not long after that. I think Ezekiel probably more immediately. And Daniel had a little growing up to do first. I think Daniel was younger. He was a young man. And I think Susanna introduced Daniel to the Hebrew community in Babylon. That's my opinion. But even in Daniel chapter 1, he's described as a youth. So when he began prophesying the Nebuchadnezzar, I mean, we do know how long it is in some instances, because Daniel mentions the year of Nebuchadnezzar, but he's kind of young. And he lasted until the Persian period, from 604 BC to Cyrus and the time he conquered Babylon in 539 BC. So that's 55 years right there. That's a long time.
He makes fools of the preterists, Bill.
Yeah, Daniel, he actually started prophesying real quick in Babylon, because he mentions this the second year of the book of Nezar in Daniel chapter 2. And at that time, he can't be much older than 18 years old, in my opinion. Maybe a little older, maybe in his 20s, but I don't think he's any older than that. And Daniel chapter 2 is basically 603 BC, a year after he's taken into Babylon.
So Daniel only lived a short, like, he might have, how long did he live?
Well, he lived in the Persian period to the first year of Cyrus. That's 539 BC.
Well, his prophecy outlived him by thousands of years. That's like the prophets don't live forever, but their prophecies do live forever.
Well, Daniel may have lived a little longer than that, but that's the end of his prophecy, according to the book of Daniel. So if he was 20 in 603 BC, then he was 64 years old. He was 84 in 539 BC. So that's a long time.
Yeah, it is. I knew he died as a real old man. Prophesied 60 years. And his prophecies still live. And the Jews try and hide him away. Sad.
And he probably had more writings than what we have.
Yeah.
I have a hunch they all did. Like the statement about Jonah in 2 Kings chapter 16. That they made a prophecy about Jeroboam 2 recovering the coasts of Syria for Israel. Well, that's not in the book of Jonah, so where is it? But they knew about it when they wrote 2 Kings 16, so where is it? We don't have it. We won't have it. Maybe in the kingdom. Maybe they'll have all the missing books on CD by then.
Yeah.
On an MP3 card.
Thank you, dear. Well, I know what I'm doing the first few years, then.
Yeah, same. All the secrets revealed. The Book of the Wars of the Lord.
Yeah, that'd be really cool, right?
Yep.
And it's mentioned in the book of Numbers, so it can't be the book of Exodus that it's talking about, or the book of Genesis. Yeah, Numbers chapter 21. Zechariah chapter 2 isn't very long.
Zechariah 2. I lifted up my eyes again and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Then said I, "Where go you?" And he said unto me, "To measure Jerusalem. See what is the breadth thereof, and what is the length thereof." And behold, the angel that talked with me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him, and said unto him, "Run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein. For I, saith Yahweh, will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her. Ho, ho, come forth, and flee from the land of the north, saith Yahweh. For I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, saith Yahweh. Deliver thyself, O Zion,
that dwells with the daughter of Babylon. For thus saith Yahweh of hosts, after the glory has he sent me unto the nations, for he that touches you touches the apple of his eye. For behold, I will shake my hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants, and ye shall know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith Yahweh. And many nations shall be joined to Yahweh in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell in the midst of thee, and you shall know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me unto thee. And Yahweh shall inherit Judah his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. Be silent, O all flesh, before Yahweh, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation. End of Zechariah chapter 2. I think of the second coming.
Yeah, that's how I equated it in my 2016 commentary. All of Israel was never regathered in the second temple. The temple is measured, and the transcendent purpose of the temple was for Yahweh to gather the children of Israel, but they weren't actually gathered in the temple. The temple enabled the ministry of Christ, whereby they were gathered in Christ in a transcendent far vision fulfillment, but never in the near vision. Flee from the land of the north, that might be interpreted as a beckoning to come back to Jerusalem, but if we read the records of Ezra and Nehemiah and those that returned to Jerusalem from captivity, most of them already returned with Zerubbabel, and there were only 42,000. Nehemiah brought some additional people with him, but for the most part, Nehemiah only recorded the returnees that came with Zerubbabel, and so did Ezra. The first six chapters, or at least five and a half chapters, I forget exactly, of Ezra actually record things which happened in the time of Zerubbabel. And then the context switches to his own time and his own ministry under Artaxerxes in I can't remember the year, 548 or 550, 558 BC, I believe, 558 BC, or thereabouts. So I could be off a couple of years. 458 BC. Thank you, David. Yes. 458 BC. So that was never a gathering of Israel. They fled from the land of the north, but that they, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven. They kept moving away from the places of their captivity in Mesopotamia and its environs, but they never returned to Jerusalem. However, Yahweh is still dealing with them, and this is another place that demonstrates that. So for that reason, because Israel was spread abroad, and many nations shall be joined to Yahweh in that day and shall be my people. That day is the day of the fulfillment of his prophecy when he does gather Israel to himself. And at that time, those many nations are the children of Israel spread abroad in fulfillment of the promise that to Abraham and to Jacob that their seed would become many nations.
And in that same verse here in Zechariah, they're being made his people in fulfillment of Hosea 2.
Yes. they shall be my people, because they were his people and they were promised that they would be his people again in Hosea chapter 2. Absolutely. So yeah, this is a far vision.
It says he shall inherit Judah, and at the same time I'm thinking that Israel will inherit the kingdom. So that's when the people become his again. That would be the future.
But the immediate context of Zechariah is to comfort the people of Judah.
Yeah.
Because they're the people he's dealing with in the rebuilding of the second temple.
Up verse 7, Bill, with this daughter of Babylon, could that be Mystery Babylon?
Well, yes, and I explained that in my commentary, too, that it has to be Mystery Babylon. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, the Babylonians never really sent colonies overseas. Like, there's a daughter of Jerusalem in Scripture, and very clearly the Israelites and daughters of, there's a daughter of Tyre in Scripture also. And very clearly, the Israelites sent many overseas colonies out from Palestine and settled in other places. And that's how they became, that's one way that they became many nations that will be joined to Yahweh in that day. But the Babylonians, the original founders of Babylon, the original emperor, if I have to say, of Babel was Nimrod, right? The first emperor of Babel. Babel and Erech and Akkad were the beginning of the empire of Nimrod, and those people were of Cush, and the only real colony they had, the Cush of Mesopotamia, was in Ethiopia and Africa. That's how Ethiopia got its name, its Hebrew name being Cush. So they never really had colonies overseas in the sense that Israel did. So there's no daughter of Babylon that's an actual colony of people outside of Mesopotamia that we can see in history.
And Israel would have to be dwelling with them too, wouldn't it? Because deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the... That'd have to be Mystery Babylon, because that's where we dwell today.
Yes, and in many aspects, ancient Babylon is a type for Mystery Babylon in Revelation, and that's why the name of Babylon was chosen to represent that those or that great center of international trade and finance and confusion, which all of that mercantilism brings upon the nations, because mercantilism is always confused and commingled nations.
That's what Babylon means, isn't it, Bill?
Yes, confusion. Babel does mean confusion. There's a lot of talk about Babel meaning gate of the gods, but I think I already disproved that. I mean, maybe it's not, maybe my proof isn't 100% developed, but I've already written against that interpretation. It means confusion. That might be in a forum. I don't remember. I wrote it somewhere from the Assyrian dictionary with citations from the Assyrian dictionary at the University of Chicago.
Maybe that's why we call people babblers today, too.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's where the word Babel comes from. It's from Babel, from confusion. No doubt.
Micah chapter 4 is another one where it has to be Mystery Babylon. And it shares a lot of language with this chapter in Zechariah. Like, the people are surrounded by all the nations. Daughter of Zion, hear it, sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion. And Micah, it's arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion. And yes, when you see Babylon being used as a type for Mystery Babylon in the Old Testament, you see this recurring pattern. I think it's in Isaiah. I know it's in the final two chapters of Jeremiah, or those near those closing chapters, that there's these prophecies of Babylon happening, and the context is concerning the people being outnumbered by all these nations, and then Yahweh fights with them in the day of battle, and they're being called to thresh in Jeremiah they're called a battle axe, in Isaiah they're a sharp threshing instrument having teeth. And you can really see that it's mystery Babylon, not just by the fact that it was never fulfilled this way with ancient Babylon, but just these recurring patterns that you see in all of these Babylonian prophecies across the Old Testament.
This be silent, O flesh, before the Lord, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation. I didn't really say it explicitly, but I sort of alluded that to the ministry of Christ in my commentary.
Yeah, when you rise up, the Son of Man, I will draw all men to myself, or something. Makes me think of that.
Yes, it should.
It also reminds me of Isaiah. There's a part that an ensign is raised up. And when it says out of his holy habitation, just how we see in the Gospels, you know, he's going to come back in the same way he left, in the same place.
Well, right, but the tomb was his habitation for a couple of days and nights.
Yeah.
Yeah, when the enemy comes in like a flood, I will raise a standard to the Lord. But anyways, yeah. this verse at verse 5, where the fire round about, that's the heaven fire, the fire come down from heaven, isn't it?
Well, towns
now
without
he
walls.
Will be to her a wall of fire round about. In other words, he will protect Jerusalem and will be the glory in the midst of her.
Well, could that be a type for the fire come down from heaven, Bill, in Revelation?
I that's possible, but I got to see a difference between a protecting fire and a destroying fire. Maybe I shouldn't.
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. A protecting fire and a destroying fire. I like them both.
Of course, yes. But I want to see what I wrote. Nevertheless, the meaning is evident. Okay, I got to back up a little. The King James Version adds words to the text which do not really appear in the Hebrew or in its Greek translations. But the Hebrew of the passage does inform us that Jerusalem would be inhabited as an open country. The word paraza means open country. That's Strong 6519. Let me see which. Speak to this one. Jerusalem shall be inhabited. Towns without walls. Okay, in verse 4. Where it says without walls, that's the word paraza, which means an unwalled village or an open hamlet or open country, as I have here. And it was interpreted by the King James translators to the phrase as towns without walls. I should have looked there first, right? The Septuagint translation omits the word, but it does appear to be present in the fragments of the verse found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Septuagint only has Jerusalem shall be fully inhabited. So, nevertheless, the meaning is evident in both the King James Version and the Septuagint, where in verse 5, Yahweh says, I will be unto her a wall, meaning that this Jerusalem of the prophecy will be without walls of its own, and God will be its wall. However, in Zechariah's time, Jeremiah's walls were built soon after the temple was built, or at least within two decades, which is when Nehemiah rebuilt the walls after Zerubbabel rebuilt the temple. Eventually, all of the significant towns of the Second Temple period Judea had walls. Rather, Yahweh is once again speaking of scattered Israel abroad, as the next verse explicitly states, that the children of Israel was spread as the four winds of heaven. Zion was spread as the four winds of heaven. So there you have it. So that hearkens to me of the prophecy that Israel is called out of Babylon, which is going on here in Zechariah, and was told to come out of Babylon and that they would dwell in the fields and be saved in the fields. And I don't know if that's Micah chapter 4 or not. I don't remember off the top of my head where it is, so I'm sort of looking for that. Oh, it's not Micah chapter 4. It's got to be Isaiah. Oh.
While Bill is doing that, I cut you off, Noble. What were you going to say?
I think I already said what I wanted to. I was just going to add,
bad Isaiah.
I think a far vision for the towns without walls would be the land of unwalled villages.
Right, and that's perfect. That makes perfect sense. It is Micah chapter 4. I thought my first instinct was right, but I couldn't find it at first. In verse 10, be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail, for now shalt thou go forth out of the city. Now here in Zechariah 2, they're being called to come forth and flee from the land of the north, right? Which is kind of similar, but not really the same. And it says, and now shalt dwell in the field, and shalt go even to Babylon, but dwell in the field, not in the city. There shalt thou be delivered, there Yahweh shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. And I see Babylon in Micah chapter 4 not as being literal, but as being, just like Egypt is often used, as being an allegory for captivity.
It also helps bookend our story.
Yes, absolutely. That the call to come out from her, my people, in Revelation chapter 18. Speaking of mystery Babylon. So thou shalt dwell in the fields, and there shalt thou be delivered.
Where it says here that for he that touches you touches the apple of his eye, that's a pretty well-known expression today. Did that originate here in the Bible? And if it did, does it have a deeper meaning than how we use it today?
You know, I can't say that the expression was never used, except in Deuteronomy chapter 32. He kept him as the apple of his eye. It's the Song of Moses, right? That's in the Song of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 32.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Psalms and Proverbs, where Solomon says, keep my commandments and live, and my law is the apple of thine eye. Well, that's the word of Yahweh in the mouth of Solomon the son. It's in Lamentations. That apple of his eye has to be a biblical phrase. I mean, that's definitely where the English speaking world must have gotten it from, is from the Bible, of course. I don't know where else they could have gotten it from. I never heard the expression except in modern literature and scripture.
Hey, Bill, I'm reading Micah chapter 4 that you mentioned where it says about the open field. Could that open field also, I'm thinking that could also be cross-reference to find grace in the wilderness. And this is the European nations. They found grace in the wilderness and received the gospel. But then they went to Babylon, which is where we're out today, where we went into captivity, the European nations. That's what that seems to be saying to me. There you will be rescued.
It might be because captivity was seen as being in the wilderness. But I think the analogy that we should come out of Babylon still stands, and yeah, that it corresponds to that.
Yeah, and I'd connect that all in too. Come out of, yeah. But there was a time when Europeans were in the wilderness, like they'd been, they're out of Jerusalem, and they find grace in the wilderness. It seems to be the story of Europeans.
Absolutely, I would agree. I was kind of sidetracked looking for apple in ancient texts to see if apple of my eye or apple of his eye would turn up, but it doesn't. I have seen many, because of the shared culture, I have seen phrases that were similar to biblical phrases in the ancient inscriptions. But not that one. Not in those inscriptions, anyway. It may have been an older adage, I'm sure.
Maybe it's because old Christians used to think the fruit in the garden was an apple, the forbidden fruit.
Five times in scripture. Apple of his eye, apple of the eye, apple of mine eye.
You know, I did like just a basic search. It's saying phrase comes from a Hebrew expression that literally means little man of the eye. It refers to the tiny reflection of yourself that you can see in other people's pupils. To be the apple of someone's eye clearly means that you are being focused on and watched closely by that person. But we use it a little bit differently now, right?
Yeah, but it seems that that's a kind of Jewy materialistic interpretation, to be honest. Psalm 17:8, keep me as the apple of the eye, hide me under the shadow of thy wings. In verse 7, which precedes that, show thy marvelous loving kindness, O thou that savest by thy right hand them which put their trust in thee from those that rise up against them. Keep me as the apple of thine eye, hide me under the shadow of thy wings from the wicked that oppress me, from my deadly enemies who compass me about. So it seems to really like imply a loving relationship.
Yeah.
Basically Amos chapter 3 verse 2, I guess.
For Yahweh's portion is his people, Jacob is the lot of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in a waste, howling wilderness. He led him about, he instructed him, he kept him as the apple of his eye. It seems to imply to me a loving relationship. A little more than just being put under close scrutiny. That's my opinion. I didn't want to stop the conversation, though. I guess we set it up for this evening, and we'll come back to Zechariah chapter 3 in a week.